Years ago, my wife and I came across this amazing book while we were in Schuller Bookstore. It was this treasure. It was a pictorial history of Grand Rapids. There are now several editions of this book, and I love these books. I love seeing these pictures of sort of familiar places, kind of like this one, this original building at Coit and Plainfield. As you see, Coit is a two-track, and Plainfield Avenue right here is a dirt road. At some point, this used to most recently was the Red Jet Cafe. Now it's empty, but it originally was a bank. And as you see, it used to be two stories, but many decades ago, there was a fire that destroyed the top floor, and the owners just never rebuilt the top floor. You know, it's easy to see pictures like this and forget something very, very real about them. See, what I love about photographic histories is the stories that have been lost with time. See, each person in the pictures have stories. They're real people with real hopes and dreams. They had real heartaches and failures. They had real successes and triumphs. So it's easy to see a picture from the 1800s or early 1900s and recognize how different their lives were and be completely unaware of just how similar their lives really were. You know, we do this with the Bible oftentimes. We read stories of heroes of the faith, and we assume that what makes them heroes is their greatness, a greatness that you and I, frankly, could never achieve, right? Completely forgetting that even the greatest heroes were just humans like us. The difference is that they made decisions that shaped themselves and future generations in incredible ways. But the truth is that you and I are faced with the same sorts of decisions today. And what it all comes down to is this. Will we trust in the Lord at all times? Well, as we've seen throughout the book of Joshua, the tribe of Judah has taken on the position, the role of firstborn, even though Judah was Jacob's fourthborn son. Reuben was the firstborn, but he engaged in illicit relations with his father's concubine, and so he forfeited his birthright. And then Simeon and Levi were next, but you remember the story where they deceived and then attacked the men of Shechem. So they lost the birthright. So fourth, next up was Judah. Judah was also the largest tribe among the 12 tribes, and so they would need the greatest amount of land. And when we come to Joshua 15, we have the longest, most detailed description of the allotment of land to one of the tribes. Now, it's said that a picture is worth 1,000 words. So instead of reading verses 1 through 12 and 20 through 62, look at the green spot. That's Judah. You're welcome. I did practice the names just in case I thought it was appropriate to read them, but I gave up. So a picture. Now you'll notice it says that, well, you maybe can't see from where you are. Simeon doesn't actually receive a separate allotment of land. Judah's land was far bigger than they needed, and so Simeon simply received cities within Judah's land. Well, after this lengthy and detailed description, we come to verse 13 of Joshua chapter 15. According to the commandment of the Lord to Joshua, he gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the people of Judah, Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. Arba was the father of Anak. And Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak. And he went up from there against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "Whoever strikes Kiriath Sefer and captures it, to him I will give Aksa, my daughter, as wife." And Othiel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it. And he gave him Aksa, his daughter, as wife. When she came to him, she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she got off her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me the land of the Negev, give me also springs of water." And he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Now, remember, in chapter 14, Caleb was given his inheritance. He is the first individual in all of Israel to receive a specific allotment of land in the promised land. And as we saw, this is somewhat surprising given that Caleb was not born an Israelite. His father, Jephunneh, was a Kenazite, one of the many nations that made up the Canaanite population. But through faith in the God of Israel, this outsider was brought inside. And so the God of Israel claimed him as his own, and he became one of the Israelites. he receives an inheritance. Verse 13 indicates that he was given a portion among the tribe of Judah. Right? Those who were foreign-born and came to believe in the God of Israel joined Israel, but they didn't join like a 13th tribe that, you know, the foreigners stay over there by themselves. They were adopted in among the various tribes. In the case of Caleb, he was adopted into the tribe of Judah. His inheritance was the city of Hebron. Hebron, of course, was a major city. It had several villages that surrounded it, land even further out that beyond that for cropland, for raising flocks and herds. The problem for Caleb is that the Anakim have returned. The Anakim, as you know, were giant men. They were known for their size and for their fierce faces. The Egyptians even feared them. Goliath was one of the last of the Anakim. But we saw back in chapter 11 that Joshua and all Israel defeated the Anakim. They drove them out from the central hill country where Hebron is. But after that victory, they lived in just the three cities of the Philistines on the coast. But as we saw, after Israel won those battles in the south, the whole army, all the people went north to battle those kings. So after Israel defeated these southern kings, the Anakim apparently have returned. It turns out that there is a difference between having the status of victory and actually experiencing that victory. I mean, when Joshua and Israel romped through the south and then the north, they defeated all the kings of these various city-states, and they thereby eliminated all of the armed and organized resistance against them. As we've seen, the conquest of Canaan was not about slaughter of entire people groups. They didn't do that. It was about eliminating the national and therefore religious identity of these people, namely in killing the kings who represented their religions. And after Joshua defeated the king of Hebron, he moved on and the people moved back into the city. And now some of the surviving Anakim have taken up residence. Now remember that it was the presence of the Anakim in the land that prevented Israel from taking the land 40 years earlier, right? They came out of Egypt, they camped around the Mount Sinai, and then they were ready to go into the land at Kadesh Barnea. Like, wait, the spy said, hey, there's Anakim there. We don't want to go there. They're big and they're mean. Israel lacked faith. Caleb acknowledged his own inability to drive out the Anakim for a second time while expressing his faith in the God of Israel. Look what we saw last week in chapter 14. Caleb says, so now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said. Again, Joshua and all Israel drove them out once before. But it turns out that there is a difference between having the status of victory and actually experiencing that victory. While Israel was elsewhere, the Anakim reappeared. These cities were empty. They just moved back in. See, sometimes a defeated enemy doesn't know he's defeated. So he keeps showing up to fight you. Even though he cannot defeat you, he keeps trying to challenge you. Caleb's humility here is actually quite remarkable. He knows what God can do. He has seen what God can do. He has participated in God's victory. He simply acknowledges that God may give him the victory over the Anakim this time. You know, verse 14 doesn't give us much detail other than to say God, in fact, gave him the victory, and Caleb drove the Anakim out of his city that day. And now he's able to settle into the city, he and his people. He's not done, however. He moves against Debir, another city that Joshua has already conquered. Again, the people have moved back in. But this time, Caleb offers a reward, one that we find really offensive. He says, to the man who captures the city, I will give my daughter Aksa as wife. Now, this sounds offensive to us for good reason, right? I mean, his daughter is given as a prize, a reward for a military conquest. Before we judge him too harshly for this, however, we must recognize that both he and his daughter would be utterly repulsed at our system of finding a spouse, a system of being emotionally invested in a serial group of people that we date one after another, hoping to connect with one, emotionally investing in them only to have that emotional investment ripped apart. I mean, finding a spouse based solely on feelings of love and romantic desire would be horrifying to them. Like, you're going to trust your feelings in this? Just as receiving a bride as a reward for military conquest is horrifying to us. Well, in Caleb's day, parents would determine who their children would marry. I don't know how much input the kids had in it. I would imagine they had some. But the idea of romance and choosing a spouse was utterly foreign to them and, frankly, to much of human history. Well, as it turns out, Caleb's nephew, the son of his brother, captured the city. And yes, that means they were cousins. Different world. Aksa was given to him to be his wife. And again, while that strikes us as offensive, in this way, Caleb was actually ensuring that his daughter's husband would be a brave and honorable man. Now, one of the reasons for his willingness to give his daughter to the victor over the city of Debir was his unrelenting faith in the God of Israel. See, just as the Israelites recognized God's sovereignty in the outcome of casting lots that we saw recently, so they recognized God's sovereignty in battle. By giving Othniel the victory, God was selecting Othniel to be Aksa's husband. In verse 18, Aksa urges her husband to ask her father for a land, for an inheritance. Remember, Caleb has been given a large area as an inheritance, which includes multiple cities and villages and surrounding land. But what she's really asking for is for her husband to request her dowry from her husband. You see, the father of the bride would give a large gift to the bride so that in the event something terrible happened to her husband, she would have a means of income. Land meant she could grow crops, but she could also raise cattle, flocks and herds. And not only could it provide her sustenance, it potentially could provide wealth. Now, the interaction between Othniel and Caleb isn't recorded for us, but it's clear that Caleb grants her request. And so she has a request. Now, I want to say that it's really interesting to me that the second person in the book of Joshua among all Israel to receive a specific allotment of land is also a Kenizzite. You see, Aksa is the daughter of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and her husband is the son of Kenaz, Caleb's brother, which means Kenaz is the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. Now, there's a problem. This land is in southern Judah. It's in the Negev, the desert, the dry, dusty land where few plants grow. I mean, do you remember what God called the land of Israel when God told them he was going to take them out of the land of Egypt? Keep in mind that when they were in Egypt, they were in Goshen. Goshen was a very wet, very green, very fertile land, perfect for raising cattle, for flocks of goats and sheep. He called it the land of that was flowing with milk and honey. Now, how would it flow with milk and honey? Well, it would grow so much grass that it would support massive herds, and there'd be so many wildflowers that bees would produce incredible quantities of honey. Well, Caleb gave Othniel and Aksa land in the Negev, the desert. It ain't flowing with anything but dust. Most of the land was actually like this. How could God say it was flowing with milk and honey? It could only flow with milk and honey if God provided sufficient water to grow that grass. In verse 18, after her husband apparently asked for a field, Aksa told her father that in addition to the dry and crumbly land that he gave them, they needed springs, right? They needed fresh water for their people, for their animals, for their crops. Now, we need to see this for what it is. This is her unrelenting faith in the God of Israel. She is looking both to their present needs, they need water to live, but also to future needs. She's trusting that they're going to have children who are going to have children who are going to continue having children. And in centuries to come, they're going to need a fresh water source. She asks Caleb for a blessing. Blessings are always from God. She trusts that God will keep them in the land and that their future generations will have the fresh water they need. Fact is, it takes a measure of faith to plan for the future. See, this isn't just about her and her children. This is about future generations. She's trusting in the God of Israel for a blessing in a desert that future generations might dwell in security. Now, she could have asked for a well. The problem with a well is that it could be fouled up. They can run dry. They could be filled in by enemies who come in and attack. But a spring flows constantly with water. So just like her father trusted in God to drive out the Anakim again, so she is trusting in God for fresh water. Now, Caleb responds by giving her the upper springs and the lower springs, whatever that means. Through these springs, God would provide fresh water to them and for generations who would come after them. So again, we need to see here that it's not just Aksa who trusts in God. See, years later, long after Joshua dies, Israel sins against God by worshiping the gods of the Canaanites, the very thing they were told not to do. So God allows a foreign king to oppress them. Look at this from the book of Judges. But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the people of Israel who saved them. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The spirit of the Lord was upon him and he judged Israel. He went out to war and the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. And his hand prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. Yes, I practiced that one a lot. My heart was beating there, making sure. So Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenazite, was Israel's first judge and deliverer after during the time of the judges. It's not hard to see why God paired up Othniel and Aksa. Both trust in the Lord with all their hearts. They trusted in him for their present and for their future. Their faith for the present and for the future remained firmly fixed in God of Israel. Now, when we consider the faith of Othniel and of Aksa and the faith of Caleb, the fact is we should be stunned. We should be stunned that they have any faith at all. See, if you know anything about the legacy of the Canaanites, and remember, Kenazites are part of the Canaanites, you would be shocked. Now, let me say that nowhere in Joshua does Joshua say the reason for the conquest was to punish the Canaanites. Joshua says that the conquest was so that God would fulfill his promise to Abraham. The land was God's land to take, and so he took it from the Canaanites to give it to the Israelites. Remember, this was not an international conflict, and God took the side of Israel against the Canaanites. God was working to fulfill his promises. However, this does not mean that the Canaanites were not a particularly sinful people. Fact is, they were. In Leviticus 18, God gave Moses instructions for the time soon coming when Israel would be in the land of Canaan. It says this: The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, 'I am the Lord your God.' You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you lived, and you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan to which I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord." Now here, God instructs Israel to not live as the Canaanites live. Right? They must not walk according to their statutes. That is their standard of living. Now, interestingly, in that Leviticus 18 text, Moses then goes on to list numerous specific sins they were to avoid. All of them were illicit sexual relations. Then God says this: "Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For the people of the land who were before you did all these abominations so that the land became unclean, lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it vomited out the nations that was before you. For everyone who does any of these abominations, the persons who do them shall be cut off from among their people." It goes on to say, the people of the land, right, the Canaanites, that includes the Kenazites, right? So we're talking about the Kenazites here. They did all these things. Israel must resist these sins. This is the legacy of the Canaanites. This is the legacy of the Kenazites. This is the family history of Othniel and of Aksa and of Caleb himself. Do you see what God has done here? God has rescued Caleb, and the result is that Caleb has now passed on a new legacy, this time a legacy of faithfulness to his daughter and to his son-in-law. Do you see what God is doing here? God is giving Caleb this new identity. See, no longer is Caleb living out the cycle that he inherited, right? The cycle is simply this: repeating the sins of your parents that were passed on to you and passing them on to the next generation. You know, Jephunneh, his father, is only ever mentioned as Caleb's father. In 1 Chronicles 4, we read a list of the descendants of the tribe of Judah. Both Caleb and his brother Kenaz are listed in the family tree of Judah, but Jephunneh is not. This suggests that both Caleb and Kenaz are first-generation believers. See, he's only mentioned there as their father, sort of like a last name, right? Caleb, Jephunneh's son, right? He's not, they're listed as heads of household, but Jephunneh is not, which means he likely remained a Kenizzite by both ethnicity, but especially by religion. I mean, if he himself were counted among the Israelites, he would have been listed as a head of household with his two sons listed as in his household. But instead of listing Jephunneh and his two sons, it only lists the two sons. But hear the good news. Caleb himself is proof that if his father had turned to the Lord in faith, he would have been counted among the people of God. He would have been a head of a household in the tribe of Judah, along with his sons. Rather than passing on the legacy of their father, both Caleb and Kenaz passed on to their children a new legacy, one that is rooted in faithfulness in the God of Israel. Both Caleb and Kenaz received a new identity. This doesn't mean that they ceased being Kenizzites, right? Their ethnicity did not change. Caleb was still a Kenizzite, even though he became an Israelite. Becoming one of God's people didn't change the fact that Caleb was a Kenizzite. Becoming one of God's people means that being a Kenizzite is no longer what it means to be Caleb. Truth is, I was a poor white kid who was rejected by both his father and his mother. When Jesus saved me, I didn't stop being a poor white kid who was rejected by his father and mother. Instead, what changed is that being a poor white kid is no longer what it means for me to be JT. What changed in my life is what changed Caleb's life. That God intervened. He drew Caleb to himself, gave him his new identity rooted in who God is, and he broke the cycle of unfaithfulness. I love how Tim Keller explains it. He says, what you and I are to do is to show others who are just like us what they would look like if they were Christians. So whether you grew up white or black, whether you grew up rich or poor, whether you grew up in a loving home or you grew up like I did, live in such a way that you show others just like you what they would look like if they followed Jesus. It isn't that your personality is going to change or that your family history is magically rewritten. It's that you no longer indulge in the sins that were passed on to you. See, Jesus breaks the cycle of sin that we were all born into. But he also breaks the lies that were spoon-fed to us. You know the lies, right? It will always be this way. You can't change, so don't bother trying. But don't expect better. Or the flip side, right? You deserve the best. So why should you have to sacrifice for anything or anyone? It should just be given to you. Right, this life is all there is, so just get as much of it as you can. These are lies that Jesus came to break. Because God has broken the cycle in my life, my children have been able to grow up in security, assured of my love for them. And the primary way they are assured of my unending love for them is my unending love for my wife. See, my father's legacy is one of unfaithfulness of woman after woman after woman, and unfortunately group of children after group of children after group of children, never sticking around for long, or in my case, if at all. By God's grace, that cycle is broken. God is doing the same thing today that he was doing in Caleb's day. Well, after listing many of the cities the tribe of Judah received as an inheritance in verses 20 through 62, we come across this interesting comment in verse 63. But the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of Judah could not drive out. So the Jebusites dwell with the people of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. You see, God broke the cycle, but the cycle's still trying to break Caleb. God gave the land to the tribe of Judah, yet the Jebusites continued living in Jerusalem. And they would do so until the time of King David. While Caleb and Othniel and Aksa had rejected the idolatry, the sins of their ancestors, that idolatry kept trying to recapture them. I mean, if you read just the first couple chapters of the book of Judges, which picks up right after Joshua dies, you'll see the danger was all too present. It was all too real. Israel is going to soon begin worshiping the gods of the Canaanites, which include the sinful practices of the Canaanites. The cycle was broken, but the cycle wants to break them again. So verse 63 stands as a sharp warning to the reader. after we've read several chapters of overwhelming victory, there remains a danger in the land. Yes, Joshua defeated the Anakim. Yes, Caleb defeated them again sometime later. But there are Jebusites who still live among them, who worship their Jebusite idols, and they are calling out to the people of Judah to come home, to come back to the ways of their ancestors, to return to the cycle that once held them. Joshua knows that Israel must resist this pull to idolatry. It is their legacy, after all. See, at the end of his life, Joshua will remind Israel of their legacy as he urges them to continue to make a new legacy, one of faithfulness to the Lord. This is Joshua 24. Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and summoned the elders, the heads, the judges, and the officers of Israel. And they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, long ago your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates, Terah, the father of Abraham and of Nahor, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him through all the land of Canaan and made his offspring many. I gave him Isaac." Isaac, of course, had Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. He was renamed Israel. Do you see Joshua's point here? Abraham, the great Abraham, the ancestor of all Israel, was born into a family of idolatry. That means Abraham himself worshipped idols, but God intervened in his life. God took him out of that idolatrous home, and he brought him to the land of Canaan. God changed Abraham from a man who served other gods to make him into a man who was faithful to the one true God. See, it wasn't that Caleb came from a really sinful family, but native Israelites come from really, really godly families. That's not at all what happened. Every single person who was counted among the people of Israel, whether native born or foreigners who were adopted in, every one of them came from a sinful family with family sins that seek to cling to them. Every single Israelite inherited family dysfunction. Every one of them inherited their family sins that will be passed on if each individual does not fight against it. The truth is, every family tree is just one generation away from unfaithfulness. It begins and ends with each generation. That means it begins and ends with each individual within that generation. Look, I know some of you come from Christian homes with parents who love the Lord. That's great. You still have family sins. Oftentimes, those sins are of the more acceptable variety, like greed or maybe latent prejudice against others, hidden racism or self-righteousness, or perhaps indifference to the suffering of others. See, these sins can be covered up by being good, productive citizens, members of society. But some of you, myself included, come from rather different homes. Our family sins were less socially acceptable and were more blatant and perhaps in your face, whether sexual immorality or drugs and alcohol abuse or violence. Those sins are much harder to cover up with a thin veneer of righteousness. And frankly, most of us who grew up in homes like that didn't even try to cover it up. Like Caleb, like Othniel, like Aksa, each one of us here is faithful with a decision. We will either pass on the sins we inherited from our families, or we will allow God to break the cycle and begin anew with us. See, if you are in Christ, you have the status of one who is victorious over sin. You were crucified with Christ. You were buried with Christ. You were raised to new life with him. But it turns out that having the status of victory is not always the same thing as experiencing that victory. See, like Caleb, sometimes you have to go back to Hebron and you have to defeat the same old enemy one more time. Defeated enemies, no doubt, even if they don't know that they're defeated, but these enemies will fight against you. God has rescued you from sin, but the Jebusites remain among us. God has claimed us as his own, and he has united us with Christ, but you must stand and you must fight in his power as you resist the pull of those family sins. See, it's easy for us to look at people like Caleb and Othniel and Aksa and think these are spiritual giants, right? That faith simply came easier to people like them. I mean, after all, they witnessed actual miracles, didn't they? I mean, I've never seen manna from heaven. Have you ever had some? I haven't. I haven't seen walls fall down because some people played some trumpets. Though I'm pretty sure if I were to sing to you right now, you'd want the walls to fall down on you. Maybe that's how they did it. Bad trumpet playing. I don't know. What we often fail to recognize is the very ordinary lives so many of them lived. See, they made daily decisions to trust the Lord. Remember, Caleb had 45 years to trust the Lord. Every day for 45 years before he received the very specific promise God made to him. And that means every day for 45 years, that man got up in the morning determining to trust the Lord that day, come what may. And when the time came for him to take possession of Hebron, you know, where the Anakim have returned, he was prepared to face the mighty Anakim again. Not because his faith was so great, but because his faith was in the one who was so great. The truth is that even if we had seen the miracles that the Israelites saw, we would still struggle with faith. I mean, think of what the apostles themselves saw, the miracles they witnessed. In Matthew 17, Matthew tells us about the transfiguration of Jesus. Jesus takes some of his disciples up this mountain, and his glory, his divine self, is revealed through his human nature. The very next thing that happens in Matthew is a man comes to Jesus with his son who is an epileptic and had seizures. And he's like, look, Jesus, I know you can do it. Your disciples, they couldn't help. They couldn't heal my son. So Jesus merely speaks a word, heals the man's son. Later in that chapter, the disciples come to Jesus like, hey, why couldn't we heal the boy? Jesus told them this. He said to them, because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. The truth is that the disciples were never able to heal someone. Only Jesus can actually heal people. But this is what faith is. It is trusting in God to do what only God can do. The reason even a little bit of faith was able to move mountains isn't that just a tiny bit of faith is so powerful that itself can move mountains, but that the faith, however big or small it is in the one who can move mountains. See, we tend to think that if we just had a little more faith, we could do more for the Lord. If we were giants of faith, like Abraham and like David, like Moses, like Deborah, like Caleb, then we could do more for the Lord. You know, this is the very opposite of what Jesus is saying to them. Do you see what Jesus was actually saying to his disciples? He doesn't tell them that the problem preventing them from healing the boy was their faith was too small. He's telling them they weren't even trusting a tiny bit. That's how small their faith was. They didn't have any faith. They were trusting in themselves, not in Jesus. You don't need much. I mean, you ever see a mustard seed? It's really tiny. Their faith wasn't even the size of a tiny mustard seed. The temptation is to wonder if we can move literal mountains. Is that, I've never seen a mountain move, maybe with an earthquake. That's not what Jesus really meant. See, Jesus came to rescue his people from sin and from death. Jesus came to set his people free. If your faith is tiny, really tiny, even as tiny as a mustard seed, then you know that Jesus is capable of setting you free. The reason Caleb could break the cycle of sin in his family tree wasn't Caleb. It wasn't him at all. It was the one Caleb was trusting in. See, Caleb's faith had nothing to do with his family tree. The truth for us today is that the only family tree that matters is the cross on which Jesus died. That's our family tree. That's what unites us. The cross is our family tree. And if you are in Christ, then your sins are still nailed to that cross, never to come off again. That's because Jesus breaks the cycles. Not only did he step into that gap between God and us, he gives us a new cycle to repeat. The gospel of Jesus is what stopped sin from destroying us. And the gospel is also what gives us the power through God's Spirit to enable us to form new patterns, new cycles of faithfulness, to change the very picture of our lives. The next time you think of a snapshot of those heroes of the faith, don't see them in a one-dimensional sort of way, right? These were real people with real struggles, with real hopes and real dreams and real shortcomings, and real faith in God. God used their individual circumstances to develop them by growing their faith, by causing them to stop repeating the sins of their families, to start repeating the faithfulness of Jesus. But God is using your unique circumstances, whatever they are, to work in your life, to stop the destructive cycles that by setting you on a new course, a new path that ultimately leads to you looking like Jesus, not like the ancestors before you. The truth is that if God did not work in our lives, we would all be stuck as Canaanites. We wouldn't be given a new identity. We'd be stuck in the cycle. We'd be enslaved by the very choices we were making. So wherever you are in life, whatever the sins are that seek to destroy you, know that Jesus Christ is the only one who can set you free. Jesus is the only one who can change your life's trajectory. Even faith the size of a mustard seed is enough to unlock the power of God in your life, because faith demonstrates that it's not dependent on you. It's dependent on the one you're trusting in. The size of your faith doesn't determine the size of God. It just points you to God, who is big enough. See, Jesus can do it, which is just another way to say Jesus has done it. So let's trust him. Let's trust him to bring rescue into our lives, to bring rescue into lives that God has placed us, the lives of those God has placed us among, that we can represent him well and live for him.